Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Principle of Hospitality, the podcast. Now, we've had a collision of worlds, a joining of forces, a banding of brothers. Sash from Principle Design and me, Sean from Open Pantry Consulting, are pleased to announce this venture for 2021, Principle of Hospitality. Now, we know that food brings people together and promotes community. And at Principle of Hospitality, we are here to disrupt current perceptions of what the hospitality industry can achieve in today's ever-evolving and challenging environment. Now, that's why we've partnered with Chef's Hat on this Principle of Hospitality podcast. Now, if you didn't know, Chef's Hat is the largest family-owned and operated hospitality supplier in Australia. They strive to inspire cooks, chefs, bakers, and bartenders to deliver the best product with the best tools every day. So that's why we're so proud to partner with Chef's Hat, where the industry shops. Now let's get into today's podcast. I think you're really gonna enjoy it. Welcome to the Principle of Hospitality podcast. Thanks so much for listening along. Mamacita has been showcasing Mexican-inspired flavors with a variety of artisanal agave spirits since 2010. The loud and bustling atmosphere curated playlist has made it a Melbourne institution perched high on Collins Street since opening. They've also done a collaboration with Three Blue Ducks where they've matched six dishes with six of their favourite surf breaks for the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. It's actually been one of my favourite venues since I've moved to Melbourne, so it's great to chat with Matt Lane, the founder of Mamacita. Hey Matt, how are you?
Very well, how are you going, Sean?
I am fantastic.
Excellent.
It's fantastic to catch up with you today to sort of learn a bit more about you the last couple of weeks since we've been speaking about your journey. And look, I've just been super excited to have this conversation today, so I really appreciate your time. So, you know, Mamacita is an institution in Victoria and in Melbourne and really started a lot of the restaurant scene that we see now in Melbourne way back in 2010. Do you want to talk about how it got to a point where you started Mamacita and why you did actually start the brand?
Yeah, absolutely, Sean. So, look, prior to Mamacita, I'd been living in New York City running a Mexican restaurant there called La Esquina. And La Esquina was, I guess, one of the first sort of really modern Mexican restaurants in New York City to launch.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, there was probably, you know, there was sort of Mexican groceries and whatnot, but there wasn't like a flagship Mexican restaurant
mm-hmm.
in New York City doing like a modern interpretation. So
yeah, right.
When I started there, that place had been going for probably about 8 months, and a bit like Mamacita, it opened up and it just exploded and went nuts.
Yes.
So I was very fortunate to land a managerial role there.
Yes.
And prior to that, I didn't know anything about Mexican food. My knowledge of Mexican food was like most Melburnians, I guess, which was based on Taco Bell and whatnot. So got there and had a very steep learning curve and a quick introduction to not only a type of cuisine that I didn't really know much about that actually blew me away.
Yes.
But also from, I guess, from a managerial's perspective, I'm as interested in Bev as much as I am in food.
Yeah, for sure.
And so the whole tequila, mezcal, agave sort of distillate range
mm-hmm.
blew my mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's I'd come from just prior to that, I'd been living in Barcelona, and then prior to that, had been in, you know, Australia for all my life, really. And, you know, I was used to making cocktails out of vodka and bourbon and scotch and all these sort of standard spirits that we all know and love so well. But
yep.
to go there – and tequila I didn't love. You know, I think I had an experience like most where mm-hmm. I had drunk some really bad quality tequila when I was 14 years old.
Yes.
As we know, it's the spirit that can keep on giving. And
it certainly does, doesn't it?
So I'd had a bad experience with tequila in my very early years and even just the sniff of it used to put me off. And then I landed at this restaurant in New York City that had over 100 different types of tequila and mezcals. And,
wow.
You know, I didn't even realise that there was a thing called, you know, like 100% agave tequila.
Yes.
I didn't realise that was even a concept. So, I quickly learned a lot about all that and it just blew my mind.
Yeah.
And I went into it head first and just really soaked it up. So, Yeah, so I spent a few years living in New York City doing that. Mm-hmm. And in that time, I also got to spend a fair bit of time in Mexico City, which was great because I got to go there and buy tequila and mezcal for the company quite a bit.
Right.
And then in 2009, I came back literally for a couple of weeks holiday.
Okay.
So I had no intention of staying back in Melbourne. I still had an apartment set up in New York City with that I shared with another really good mate of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Who was an American guy, and got back here and got some news that my mum wasn't too well, so put sort of my return trip on hold for a bit.
Okay.
At that point, Andrew McConnell had just opened up Cumulus, mm-hmm. And I'd worked with Andrew before at Circa, and one of the main manager at Cumulus, Madeline Morgan, is an old mate. So she said, you know, why are you here? Why don't you come and work at Cumulus for a bit? So I went and worked there for a little bit. And then got offered to do this consultancy gig at a place called the Recording Music Studio, which is where Mama Cedar is now.
Yes.
So it was a bar on the top of Collins Street.
Right.
At that time, Collins Street was a ghost town. It was a really, really sort of quiet end of town.
Yes.
Much like Flinders Lane, really.
Yeah.
You know, at that time, Cumulus had opened up and went gangbusters. But prior to Cumulus, there was really Movida down in Hosier Lane.
Mm-hmm.
There was Ciccone's, the old stalwart, you know, fantastic, amazing Italian restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a whole lot else. There was Rosati's that had its sort of time in the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there wasn't a whole lot happening in Flinders Lane.
Mm-hmm.
So Cumulus opened. Just, you know, the way that place opened and the way it operated and the queues they used to have every single night was just incredible to watch.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot working with those guys. Mm. And then, yeah, as I say, I went over to do this consultancy on this bar to try and sort of turn it around and just, you know, look at some improvements.
Yeah.
And I was only meant to be there for a month before I was going to head back to New York City.
Uh-huh.
In that time, a couple of things happened. I met a girl who's now my wife and mother of our two kids.
Always away.
But also while I was doing this consultancy gig, I just started mucking around with a business plan for a Mexican restaurant in Melbourne because I was looking around Australia going, why is there no, there wasn't really any modern Mexican more authentic style Mexican.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There was a place called Los Amates on Johnson Street,
mm-hmm.
Which was very authentic.
Yes.
Very specifically regional as well. You know, Mexico is one of those countries a bit like, I guess a lot of countries, but I travelled a bit in India and what blew me away in India is everywhere you go from city to city, the cuisine can be really different.
Really different, right? Mm.
Yeah, and it's the same in Mexico. So this restaurant, Los Amates in Johnson Street, I used to love it. It was very, very authentic, but it was so specific that I think it was just possibly too specific for the Melbourne palate. A lot of people didn't really get it.
Yes.
There was also another restaurant called Blue Tongue, which was over in St Kilda.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, they were the first ones to sort of start doing things a little bit different, like quesadillas and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But again, it was still, for me, it sort of, I just wanted to do something a bit broader and a bit more open and a bit more, I guess, in line with the Melbourne palate. So, so I started mucking around doing this Mexican business plan. Then my best mate, who was living in New York City, running a group over there, he was kind of looking for something new as well. And I said, well, why don't we do a Mexican restaurant together? So he flew back.
Right.
He'd been living in New York City at that stage for 10 years. And after 2 months of looking around Melbourne, he just said, I can't do this. I've got to go back to New York City. It was just too quiet for him.
Right, okay.
Which was funny because I remember when I first got back, you'd walk around the city in Melbourne of a night and you'd just think, where is everyone?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's mm-hmm. I've not been to London, but I imagine it's a similar sort of vibe. It's mm-hmm. you just get used to that onslaught of people all the time.
Yes.
So he went back and then one day one of the owners of the Recorded Music Studio came downstairs while I was working on the business plan and asked me what I was doing. I said, oh, I'm just playing around with this thing.
Yes.
He looked at it and got really excited by it and said, why don't we do it here? At that time, I was really just sort of waiting to see what was happening with my mum and her illness,
mm-hmm.
which all came good. So it was
okay. That's good.
It was a great outcome. Yeah, absolutely. And my new girlfriend and I, now wife, we started talking a lot about moving back to New York City.
Right.
As I say, I still had my apartment there, all my clothes were there, everything was sort of set up.
Yes.
And then that conversation went on for a couple of months, and I kept on saying, look, I don't think I'm going to do it, and I kept on saying, let's do it. And then in the end, we just went, why not? Let's just maybe do it for a year and then we'll get out of the business and we'll go back to New York City. So
can you remember what point made you make that decision? Was there a significant moment?
I won't lie. It was the deal.
Right. That's good.
It started off
if the opportunity is right.
That's exactly right. You know.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what it all came down to in the end. Mm. So, yeah, so that was probably in, I'm going to say that was in like November of 2009 that mm-hmm. we agreed to say let's do it.
Okay.
The place, the venue then, so these guys had taken on this venue and got a license and they wanted to turn it into like a bar with music.
Right.
And then they had a 2 a.m. license and they very quickly realised that they couldn't get a live music license. So they'd sort of operated this thing and tried to turn it into a bit of a cafe and a bit of a bar.
Right.
They pretty much had like a very, very basic kitchen set up.
Yes.
And were doing sort of pressed sandwiches and a few salads and whatnot.
Right.
Trying to figure out what they were going to do. So we, they'd had the place for a few years and didn't really want to throw any more money at it. And I sure. didn't have a whole lot of money either. So we ended up, we set the whole restaurant up with new furniture, new tables, new banquet seating and a kitchen in place for 120 grand, which
wow,
you just couldn't do these days really, you know. But we also just, we didn't have the money, so we had to get creative. And so we set it up and set it up quite minimally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the look isn't, I wanted to create a space that was really contemporary Melbourne, not like a place you'd expect a Mexican restaurant to look like.
Yeah, sure.
But that was also because, we just didn't have the cash to throw a lot of design at it.
Yes.
So myself and one of my mates at the time, his wife was a studying architect, her and I sort of designed it together and
right.
with very little coin we threw it together and then did a soft opening sort of very early 2010.
Yep.
And, by the start of February we're open. So we kind of made a decision in November and 3 months later we're open, up and running.
Yeah. How did the soft opening go? What did you do? Have family and friends?
Yeah,
did
we just invited a whole lot of mates.
So yeah, right.
We invited about 60 friends. And that was great. Like a lot of those guys had never tried that style of food before as well. Mm-hmm. And so they were all pretty blown away and really excited. And then the next night we opened and we opened the doors and there was myself on the door. I think we had two on the floor, one in the bar and probably three in the kitchen.
Right.
And we opened the doors and about sort of 10 minutes in, my bartender looked at me and said, oh, someone's ordered a fresh orange juice. And we only had two tables in the restaurant. And I said, okay, what's the problem? And he said, we don't have a juicer. And I went, oh, yeah, right. Yeah, we forgot that little detail. You know. So I ran behind the bar with him and I said, oh, which table is it?
Mm.
Out of the two in the restaurant. And he pointed to the table and I looked over and it was Nina Rosso, who was Nina is an amazing food writer.
Yes.
And she was writing for The Age at the time and was, you know, like the food writer for The Age. Mm-hmm. And I looked across at her and I just went, oh, my God, it's Nina Rosso. So we quickly grabbed a fork and we both stuck it into the orange and just started sort of hand-squeezing this orange juice. And then we ran it over to her and the whole time I was just thinking, who comes on your first night to do a review? You know, I had heard that she'd be reviewing us, but didn't realise it was going to be on her first night.
Right.
So on the way out the door, I caught her at the bottom of the stairs and I said, so, Nina, and she went, oh, I've given it away. And I said, yeah, well, you have. I said, partly because I know who you are and partly I heard that you were heavily pregnant. And she said, well, that's why I've had to come in. Like, she was about to give birth literally that week.
Right.
And she said, I just want to get this in.
Oh, so that's why she did it. Right.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. So she couldn't have been more lovely at the door and apologised and whatnot. And she just said, look, honestly, you've got nothing to worry about. It was amazing. So that sort of put my mind at ease a bit.
Yeah, right.
And then a couple of days later, we got a review in the Age Good Food Guide. Mm-hmm. Age Good Food. And it was it just said the perfect premiere was the title.
Wow.
And it was a really glowing review. So
wow.
From that minute on, it just went exploded. And rest is history.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah. Was the feedback from people like what you would expect? Like obviously you had pulled together a menu and a style that, as you said at the start, was largely very different to what was happening in the Melbourne scene. Like I would imagine that you were anticipating that customers would go, wow, like this is fantastic. But obviously if you've got, from what I've heard at that time, like massive lines around the block to get in this venue, like were you surprised by how much the Melbourne society actually loved what Mamacita was?
Oh, we were completely blown away.
Look,
we very intentionally did this whole, we're not doing nachos, we're not serving Corona, we're not really wanted to, we really spoke a lot about what we weren't
going
to be.
Yes.
which, you know, in hindsight had its pros and cons. But we just kind of wanted to go, we're really authentic and we're going to be this and we're going to be that. And it's funny when I look back at it. So Jace Jones, who was the head chef that I did it with at the time, Jace had never been to Mexico. Didn't know anything about Mexican food. The space we're sitting in now, Hotel Jesus, he actually used to live out the back here in an apartment. This is how I discovered this space.
Wow.
And we spent we'd met in Byron years before. He was a head chef of a place called The Balcony up there, and I had a restaurant up in Mullumbimby. And we'd met there and we had become mates, but not great mates. We'd met a few times through some other people. And so when I was looking to do the Mama Cedar thing, I didn't have a chef in mind. And I was talking to Andrew McConnell a bit because he'd spent time in Chicago and knew a bit about Mexican food. And, you know, I was trying to say, come on, Andrew, let's do it. But, you know, he had bigger fish to fry. you know, than starting a Mexican restaurant. And so I didn't have a chef. And then I eventually had heard that Jace was back in Melbourne, heard that he'd been head chef of a place called Orange, which was a cafe in Windsor that was really an amazing place at the time as well. And hit him up and said, look, this is what I want to do. Do you want to do it? And if you don't know Jace, Jace is one of those guys, he's just a go-getter. You know, he just, he loves a new challenge, loves to put himself in outside of his comfort zone. So we spent a bit of time in this apartment out the back of here. Because I know food and I know Mexican food quite well. Like I did at that point. I'd spent time living in Mexico after working for this group as well. Or in between. And so I knew what it should look like and taste like, and he knew how to cook. But I guess, again, in hindsight, the beauty of it is I wanted it to be really authentic. He didn't – we didn't really know authentic recipes and how to put them together. You know, they're not something you can read out of a book and do. You know, you really have to have the tradition of it being passed down from family to family and all that sort of thing. You know, I think a lot of people think tacos are really easy and you just come up with something and smash them out. But to make them – really well, it's a lot of inside knowledge and you know,
understanding
and handover of techniques and tricks and all that kind of stuff. So the menu he put together, I wrote the menu and then he did his interpretation of what I wrote, and we came up with this. I guess when I look back at it, it was like an Aussie Mexican
menu. It's like a hybrid.
And the only way I think that we got away with calling ourselves authentic was that we used soft tortillas instead of crunchy ones. So I think for most people, they were like, oh, they're not crunchy. It must be authentic. But, you know, Mexicans coming in, we're sort of probably going, well, there's nothing authentic about this at all. But it tastes good. So, again, in hindsight, that was probably perfect, because had we been more authentic than that, maybe it wouldn't have been nearly the success that it was. So, yeah, so that was interesting too, because no one made soft tortillas in Melbourne. There was a lady called Marie Diaz up in Sydney. So we used to get them flown down every day. A lot of the ingredients weren't really readily available. In Melbourne, we had to source things or import things. Mezcal tequilas, we're going over there and filling up our backpacks and bringing them back through. there was a lot, you know, in true sense of the Mexican word, there was a bit of bit of sneakery going on to get the right ingredients and the right products.
What about the agave spirits and that kind of stuff? Like, how that? What was people's take on that when you first opened? Did they understand it?
There was a lot of, you know, we want some lemon and salt. And again, that was one of those, no, that's not what we are. My attitude to all that's changed a lot over the years. Now I'm like, just give people what they want. Don't try and force education down their throat. But but I think back then, probably being a bit younger and a bit more bravado, and also having the, like, we could be that, because there was no other, no one else doing it. You know, we could sort of go, this is who we are and this is what we're doing. So we didn't, if people would ask for that, rather than say no, we'd say, look, how about you try it with this? And so when we first started serving Blanco Tequila, we served it with the sangrita. A sangrita is a concoction of, it's basically like a red salsa with clamato or tomato juice. And the idea is that because Blanco is a very young expression of agave, when you have it with a sangrita, it brings out a lot of the tasting notes from the agave. So you're meant to sit between the two. So it didn't really matter. So people would go, I want lemon and salt. And we'd go, how about you try this instead? And they'd have that and go, oh, wow, that was amazing. You know, like, I think if you can, if people come in wanting something and you can convert that experience into something that they haven't tried before, and they walk out having learnt something in a way that is done in a humble way, I guess, you know, not sort of saying this is the better way, but why don't you try it? Then I think people walk away going, we didn't just go out for dinner. We came out with it. The whole experience.
We really understand that brand and what they're actually, you know, actually doing, right?
That's right. So we took that steps further in the years to follow. So when we first opened, we were predominantly a tequila bar. Mm-hmm. We only said it had 100% blue agave tequilas.
Yes.
And again, prior to that, so tequila can be called tequila as long as it's got 51% agave in it.
Right.
49% of that can be sugar.
Right.
And that's all the tequila that we all grew up in on mm-hmm. and drunk mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. woke up with terrible hangovers and yep. whatnot.
Hence why.
That's right. Mm. Pure tequila, though, you don't get that because it's right. got no, it's got none of those sugars in it. So yeah. it is 100% from the agave plant, and yeah, right. and the flavour, the taste, the after effects, the whole experience is completely different. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people didn't know that. Mm-hmm. We also brought in a few tequilas that had much more sort of a vanilla and a caramel note around them, and we'd often use those tequilas to first introduce people to it.
Right.
Because they tasted a little bit more like a whiskey or something that right. they were more familiar with.
Yeah, fair enough.
We're also really lucky in the team that I had when we first launched was just the dream team. I had had a guy named Hugo who owns Little Hop down mm-hmm. on Brunswick Street, Fitzroy. Mm-hmm. Hugo had been – he was one of the head bartenders at Cookie just yeah, before right. that, and Cookie was the place, yeah, you know, when we opened was. Mama Cedar. And Hugo didn't know much about the world of tequila and agave distillates back then and yep. really embraced it, really got into it. So he was a fantastic person to have behind the bar. Mm-hmm. We had all the team really got into it. It was a bit like me. Like yeah. I got so blown away by this new product that the team we pulled together, we were all hospo mates. We'd all worked around Melbourne for a long time. And then, you know, we kind of got them all together and said, hey, this is what we're going to do. And everyone was equally as excited about it because it was just something so new at the time.
Yes.
So having that energy on the floor and behind the bar was just brilliant.
Yeah.
You know? That's the one thing I really remember the most about that first year. The best feedback I got was just how awesome the staff were.
Yeah, right.
Which is so key.
Yeah.
And then over time we took that further and further. So 6 months into the business, a guy named Nick Peters came on as the assistant manager. Mm-hmm. Nick had worked with a really old mate of mine at a nightclub called 161.
Oh, yeah.
And other places. We kind of had mutual friends. So he came along, got involved in the business, and then probably a couple of years in, we were just trying to find Nick became a partner by that stage, and yeah, then right. we were trying to find our positions within the business, what our roles were going to be. Mm-hmm. And so he went off and did a mezcalier training course over in Mexico, which is mm-hmm. a bit like a sommelier okay. course, right? Mm-hmm. So he came back with the certification of being the only mezcalier, trained mezcalier in Australia. Wow. And we started a mezcalier program at Mama Cedar.
Wow.
So what that meant was that, you know, a lot of restaurants will have a sommelier on the floor that yes. walks around and talks about wine. Well, we had mezcaliers trained up that would do their certification to then walk around the room and teach people, talk to people about tequila and all the different agave spirits.
Wow.
And so that became a thing where we trained a group of the staff, but we also opened that up to the public. So we'd have mezcalier trainings and we'd often have 40 people in the room, you know, we'd do it on a time when we weren't open.
Yeah.
Or in between lunch and dinner on a Saturday. And and Nick and myself and others, Lewis, who's the GM now, has been for some time, who's an encyclopedia of knowledge on all things agave.
Yes.
That we'd do these training sessions, which would be for our staff, but also whoever wanted to come and attend.
Yeah.
And that really, I think that really set things apart a bit. You know, there was yeah. no one else doing, like by that stage too, Mexican restaurants were opening up left, right and centre.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were just trying to continually look for things that would set us apart from the rest and,
yeah,
and,
right.
and to try and, it's difficult when you're the first and you set a bar, but then having the ability to keep raising that bar is the, I guess, the biggest challenge.
So did you think that loyalty was a big part of the success at the start? Obviously, you're having these customers who are coming in and getting this education piece, both from in-store, you know, in-restaurant experience, but also these, you know, Saturday trainings and that kind of stuff. And then you're continually having a conversation with them, and then you're obviously training your staff really well as well. So then they're delivering on a great customer experience consistently as well. Like, was it all just about loyalty with everyone who was coming into connection with the brand?
I guess unintentionally.
Yeah.
Like it was not, we didn't.
It wasn't part of the process, obviously.
No, we didn't sit down and go, all right, what's our loyalty strategy? Let's work something out. It was yeah. just what we did because we loved it.
Yeah, okay.
Bottom line. And we also at that time, so when we first opened, we used to have the taco, we'd have the full menu available till 11 p.m. and then we'd have a taqueria menu. Basically tacos and quesadillas yeah. open until 2 a.m.
Wow.
We also opened with, we had turntables behind the bar and yeah. DJs that would play sort of 3-4 nights a week and that kind of thing. So I was trying to bridge that gap of it's a restaurant that turns into a bar, et cetera,
yes.
et cetera.
Yeah.
And we really wanted to focus in making it a hospitality place. So we used to get a lot of the hospo workers around the city that would finish their shifts at 11 p.m. that would come in and drink tequila and eat tacos till 2 in the morning. And I guess that's how that fed into itself, because they'd come in the afternoon, they'd do the course, they'd do the training, and then, you know, one night after work they'd go, oh yeah, let's go back there and drink some more tequila that we've learnt about last week. So,
that's really sick.
So yeah, that worked really well. It was great.
How have you seen, what are the couple of big things you've seen that's changed in the hospitality industry in the last sort of 10 or 11 years since you've opened the brand? Like, do you think part of what Mamacita was doing back in 2010 was really showcasing what some brands are doing now, and you sort of built a bit of a movement there? Like, what are you seeing some of the changes?
Yeah, look, I guess so. I mean, there's some exceptional Mexican brands out there now. I think it's come a long way. Like, I think when we first opened, quite a few opened up. And it's funny, like, I feel like, I don't want to sound arrogant or whatever in this way, but I feel like when we first opened, and then a lot of restaurants opened up doing kind of the same story as us.
Yes.
Whereas I don't feel that's the case anymore. I think it's really evolved. You know, there's some exceptional, there's Taquito down in Carlton. I think what they're doing is fantastic. Really exceptional food, really good flavors and whatnot.
Yes.
You've got Todd's place down the road here, Tortas and Tacos, you know, which is kind of one of those things I would love to have done at the start, rather than, and what I considered doing at the start, rather than a restaurant, because I didn't have the money to do a big scale restaurant. And that's, you know, like, you walk up and it's a taco cart on the street, and it's really what you get in Mexico. And then you got guys, there's a place called Maze, Mexican street food, that's just opened in Newtown in Sydney. It looks amazing. They're a brunch place at the moment, and the food they're doing is very authentic with a really nice modern sort of aesthetic to it.
Yeah, right.
And then you've got the boys at Tequila Mockingboard and Esteban up in Sydney. You know, they're doing really forward-thinking Mexican food. So, yeah, look, I think initially there was a really big sort of, let's just do tacos because they're really easy and Mamacita's got a queue and we can open up and do tacos and we'll be busy as well.
Yes.
I think that was that happened. And then a lot of those ones slowly sort of faded away. And then, you know, the good ones have stayed on. Another example is Mesa Verde in the city. You know, I love what they do. And then you've got the guys like Fonda who are doing, you know, something completely different, which totally has its market. You know, it's, I love what those guys do. I think that they came, they in a way revolutionized another aspect of the whole hospitality arm, you know. So I love it. You know, I think the more people, the more Mexican there is, the more people eat Mexican.
Yes.
You know, so.
Which is usually only a positive thing, right?
That's right. Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, like, I came from doing this in the States to doing this here in the States. It's like billions of them. So you've just got to find your little niche and find what you do and deliver it well.
Yeah. I remember, as I was saying to you before the podcast, you know, I worked for Grilled for a long period of time, and especially in the time when you, like, when I started with them, like, a couple of years after you guys started and opened, and I remembered they used to fly us down, the best sort of managers, I was lucky to be one of the best in the country, and come down to Melbourne and see what real hospitality was, because we were moving to a different level of hospitality in that sort of QSR burger space, and we wanted to move into sort of fast casual, you know, premium fast casual restaurants and stuff. And like, yours was one of the ones that I got invited to with a couple of other managers and stuff.
Great.
And I just remember being blown away, completely blown away that night about how just incredible, like, the service was, the attention to detail, the knowledge, as well as the product.
Yeah,
but it was the experience that, you know, that really formulated that. And I want to understand from your perspective, because I found that, like, a lot of venues that are on a second level or a third level, if you ever have to get a customer to go upstairs, it's unless you have to be destinational.
Yep.
It seems to be a lot harder if you're not at street level.
Yep.
To make it work.
Sure.
Like, how have you made sure that, you know, over 10 or 11 years, Matt, that you've created a brand that people continually want to come back to and want to experience all the time? Like, to have that experience for such a consistent long period of time must have been a real challenge.
Yeah, it has been. And again, as we touched on before we started the podcast, I think we were really lucky. You know, I really do. I mean, I think the timing was everything. It's and I think we offered something other than just Mexican food, because I don't think our Mexican food's the best in Australia. Like, I don't. Like, I think the Mexican food's really, really good. But I think Mamacita is very much about the entire experience, as you say. Like, you sort of, you go up, you know, you rock up to a 7-Eleven and there's little door and you walk up these dodgy stairs and all of a sudden you're in this room that's got this energy of, you know, it's vibrant and it's exciting and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you have that sensation before you've even put some food in your mouth. So I think it's more than just that. It really is the whole package. As far as how do you maintain that, I think you've just got to keep adding to the offer.
Yes.
You know, that's the way. If you become sort of stagnant and complacent, then things wither away and die. So I guess the way we've worked on doing that is when we first opened, we were very much a street food restaurant.
Right.
And that's what we pitched ourselves at.
Right.
You know. We also were quite a different experience for, at like forgetting the whole Mexican thing, putting that to the side for a second, just as a restaurant, we were quite different. So again, I remember when I first got back from the States, I found that restaurants were either fine dining or they were cafes. There wasn't
anything in between.
There really wasn't, you know. And I think when I started at Cumulus, that was kind of in between. Like it didn't have, you know, linen on the tables and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It was loud. It was bustling. It was incredibly busy, like just a machine of a business. The food was excellent. The service was excellent. And I think that they kind of started that movement, and Movida, to be fair, as well, in a way, you know. But both of those places, I loved those places, but I couldn't, you know, as a, I think I was, 30-something, 31 or something then, and working in hospo, I couldn't afford to go out to those places.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Even once a week. Like I wouldn't walk out with at least spending $150, $200, you know. So I wanted to create something that had really good food, had really good service, was a really exciting, bustling place, but was more accessible and approachable from, from your wallet point of view.
Yes.
So we sort of set out to, we wanted to hit a target of about $50 a head check spend of food and drink.
Yep.
And we kind of sat on that for the first few years. So our place had to be a numbers game.
Yep.
It was why we couldn't take reservations. We're only an 80-seater restaurant.
Yes.
I think there was a lot of people didn't understand that, and a lot of people got really annoyed by that, that we didn't do reservations. But there's no way we would have survived as an 80-seater restaurant doing reservations at $50 a head. Like, you do the math and on what that means revenue-wise versus the rent and the running expenses and everything else, and then it just wouldn't have been sustainable.
Yes.
And the other thing I really learnt in New York City is queues bring queues.
Yes. You know? Yes.
New York City, they're the king of it. It's, you know, all the places that have a queue, like, you don't even know what you're lining up for half the time. You see a queue and you jump on the end of it. You know, it's really...
It's got to be good if there's a queue there.
That's right. Yeah, and that's you know, as far as a marketing tool, that's the marketing tool. So, yeah, it was completely and utterly nuts those first, I'm going to say, 5-6 years of Mamacita, when I would start work at 5 p.m. and I wouldn't walk into the restaurant for the first time until about 9 o'clock at night. My whole first 4 hours of the shift was spent out on the street just taking names and numbers and saying to people, look, it's going to be a three-hour wait. And they'd go, yeah, yeah, no worries. We'll put our name down and they'd come back. And it was just like just bizarre. Yeah, really bizarre. But, yeah, look, getting back to the point of how you maintain that. So, yeah, we started out as a very much a street food restaurant and my mission statement for Mamacita has always been is to mimic Mexico City. Not Mexico as a whole. It's too challenging, but Mexico City. So when we launched, Mexico City was all about tacos and street food.
Yeah.
You know, even the cool sort of young kids that were opening up places in Mexico City were street style places. And over the last 5 years, and again 10 years ago, I know a lot of the really, really good Mexican chefs would leave Mexico. They'd go work in the States. They'd go to a lot of their training in places like Chicago and New York City and California as a whole. And then it feels like 5 years ago in Mexico, they all started to come back to their homeland and started opening up these incredible modern Mexican restaurants. And I think Enrique Olvera has got a fair bit to do with that. You know, he opened up Puyol. Which quickly became one of the world's best restaurants. And all of a sudden, I think a lot of other Mexican chefs realised, hey, there's an appetite for this back in our hometown. We don't have to be elsewhere.
Yep.
So over the last 5 years, there's been this massive movement in Mexico of really modern Mexican food that's kind of a bit more upmarket. And that's where we've been playing to in the last few years. So we opened up as this street food restaurant. Then all of a sudden, all these other street food restaurants opened up in Melbourne. And the last few years, we've just been going, no, we need to elevate this offer, particularly now since COVID. You know,
Of course.
That was the one big thing for us. Mamacita was a numbers game. You know, we used to do 500 covers a night, but that took five sittings a night, you know, more. And that was really, really hard going. As now, we're lucky to do, we do two sittings now since COVID. Mm-hmm. And so the offer, we've slowed things down now. We want people to stay longer. We want the offer to be more elevated. We want the dining experience to be more elevated. We've gone back to uniforms. We've gone back to linen napkins. We've done a complete 180 on where we were from when we first opened.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's but again, it's because I think you got to evolve.
Yeah.
Like if we just say what we were doing 10 years ago, like there's 100 restaurants in Melbourne doing that now.
Sure. Yeah. It's evolution, not revolution, right?
That's right.
I want to get into the COVID stuff in a minute. A burning question for me is like, you're talking about this brand where you're, you know, you're out in the street for 3 hours, you know, getting people to come back in and all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure that sort of died down a bit, but every time I've been to Mama Cedar, it's busy as hell. Is there a reason why you haven't done a second Mama Cedar or a third Mama Cedar? Did you just want to keep the one intrinsic experience and have that as being, you know, the brand hero?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I guess it's a couple of things. We opened up Mama Cedar and my wife and I got pregnant within the first 2 months of opening. And then we had a couple of kids.
Yes.
So that, you know, that takes up some time. And I wanted to be really to be present for all of that. And yeah, I'm not really into the like brand upon brand. I think some restaurants do it, some places do it really, really well. I personally, it's not that I'm not into it. I just don't know if I'm good enough at it.
Right.
You know, I don't know if I'm that type of person that can be overseeing three or four venues in three or four different locations.
Sure.
And doing that well. I could probably just hire someone to do that job for me for sure.
Sure.
It's not just me. I've got partners in the business too. I had some partners in the early stages and they've since changed. They got bought out by some other business partners a few years ago. And I think my earlier partners would love to have seen that happen and seen more. But I was the only one involved in the business.
Right.
And I just didn't have the space for it personally.
Yeah, sure. It's hard when you're controlling a really great experience to then go and do that in a second or third venue, right? And then continue that same high expectation that I'm sure you would have had for Collins Street.
That's right, yep.
You just touched on COVID then. It's been really interesting to see Melbourne brands, obviously, which was hit with a really hard lockdown period in 2020, and great experience led brands like yourself who have survived that time, who have done okay during that time. Do you want to talk about how you guys did survive that time and you're still standing and still evolutionary in the brand and what you're looking forward to in 2021 for the brand?
Sure. COVID was tough.
Yeah.
Like anyone will say. Yeah, so initially we just closed down Mama Cedar, and Mama Cedar was closed for 9 months of COVID. We considered doing a takeaway offer out of there in the city. But I was in the city working quite a bit, Sean. I was in there most days, and it was just an absolute ghost town. And it felt like there was no one really living in the city.
Yeah. A lot of international students were gone.
A lot of international students were gone. Yeah, absolutely. So we weren't sure on what sort of whether that would even be viable doing that. I should also mention we lost our entire kitchen team. So our entire kitchen team were international.
Right. Wow.
So not one of them were supported. So we lost our head chef, our sous chef, the whole team.
Wow.
For the first couple of months, we paid a few of them just out of our own pocket because we kind of kept on thinking, yeah, surely they're going to get some support.
There's a break to this.
The support's going to come.
You
guys are a lot of you guys are visa holders or you're sponsored. You've been paying taxes. Surely.
Yeah.
And then I think it was about 2 months in or 3 months in, we realised that the support wasn't coming, and we had to just say to them, look, guys, we can't afford to keep paying you, and you know, we're not sure where to go. So a lot of them sort of, half of them went home and half of them went and found other things.
Right.
So that was really, really tough. We also consolidated. So we did like a hybrid takeaway offer out of Hotel Jesus. It was like a Mama Cedar and Hotel Jesus operation. So we sort of consolidated the two teams of staff into the one venue, which we did over here in Collingwood.
Yes.
About probably... I'm going to say about 4 months in or 5 months in, Shane Delia hit me up and said, you guys want to jump on Providor?
Yep.
Which we really wanted to, but we just had the one menu rolling out of Hotel Jesus, and it really was a Hotel Jesus menu.
Right.
And Shane wanted a Mama Cedar menu. So we didn't have that up and running at that point, but we're about to launch Mama Cedar on tour, which is a thing that we ended up doing that's kind of saved our ass.
Yeah, right.
So that was... There was a few other restaurants doing a similar thing. I guess the most notable one was the guys from Mr. Miyagi.
Yes.
And they did that really well. It was incredible to watch. Mm-hmm. So we jumped onto that pretty quickly after seeing those guys. We started doing these, like, essentially the same thing, pop-ups out of the suburbs where it was a pre-order thing.
Yes.
And they went nuts.
Yeah.
We had,
are you surprised how nuts they went?
Oh, we were blown away. It was incredible. It was incredible. We were doing sort of 150 to 200 covers a night. You know, it was like 12 pickups every 15 minutes for about 3 hours, where people just pay their banquet prices, come in and take it all home. But we tried to curate that Mamaceta experience as much as we could for them. So we did like a Mamaceta QR code that had a link to our Mamaceta playlist and whatnot. So
yeah, nice.
And had like instruction sheets on how to put everything together. And the first thing was, you know, get home, upload Spotify, get Mamaceta music into your living room.
That's sick.
You know, and we got really, really good feedback on that.
Yeah.
We had one horrendous night out in Mordialloc where things just didn't go to plan. We had issues with all sorts of issues left, right and centre. It was a bit of a debacle. But,
but you got through it.
Yeah, well, there was a bit of flack back on that one. But other than that, that was our only sort of mishap. Other than that, they all seemed to go really, really well. We had some amazing experiences with most of them.
Yeah.
So we were doing takeaway delivery out of Hotel Jesus, and then we were doing these pop-ups on Friday, Saturday nights.
Right.
But essentially we were doing it all out of Hotel Jesus, like we're prepping the food here and the whole bit.
Right.
And then once we got that going and we had a menu for the Mamaceta pop-ups, then I gave Shane a call back and said, oh, great, we've got a menu now, we can do private all. Mm-hmm. So we started doing the two of them. Mm-hmm. Very quickly we found we couldn't do it out of Hotel Jesus, so we went and some our business partners have got another restaurant in the city, so we went and used their space and their kitchen.
Right.
So we moved our whole operation across to there, and that's where we did private all and the Mamaceta on tour pop-ups from. And we did that for probably 3 months, I'm going to say.
Yep.
4 months.
Yep.
And that really saved us.
How did you handle all that change during that time, Matt? That's a lot, right? Like you're talking about, okay, well, you would have had a lot of people going, okay, we want you to pop up in this area or this area or this area. You've got to have a gut feel about if Mamaceta on tour is going to work in that particular that particular suburb.
Yep.
And you've done it here at Hotel Jesus.
Yeah.
And then it's grown.
Yeah.
And then you've decided, no. Well, we need to make sure we focus on Hotel Jesus in the actual venue itself and then move across town and move all these ingredients and move all this operation, right? Mm. How are you doing that as a – plus you're in the city yourself seeing this cataclysmic failure.
Oh, the city was bizarre.
That was the city, right, during those period of time during 2020.
Yep.
How were you managing that yourself with the brand?
Yeah, look, it was really tough. I also had the kids at home and I was homeschooling them because my wife had just got a full-time contract like a month before COVID hit. Thank God.
Yes.
Because I ended up on JobKeeper like all the rest of the staff. So, yeah, that saw us through. But that was, you know, so I was sort of homeschooling them during the day and then doing this stuff at night. It was intense. I've never worked that hard in my life. It's definitely been the toughest year of my life. But I know that there's a million of more of me out there who would say the same.
Yeah.
I think there was a few things that really got me through. So one was part of the Mamaceta Group now is owned by 100 Burgers. 100 Burgers are a hospitality brand or group that own quite a few venues. So we were catching up once a week on Zoom.
Okay.
And that was myself and the venue managers or department heads of all their other entities.
Yep.
And that support was incredible. Like we just really, once a week, we'd all just catch up and just talk about what was happening in our venues and what was happening with our staff. And I guess a big part of that conversation was mental health, not just for ourselves, but all the staff and whatnot. So that was fantastic. I also had a couple other mates in hospitality that I was catching up with, you know, once a week or once every couple of weeks, a few other restaurant owner friends. Mm-hmm. And so what it really, like the way that the community branded together through that stage was incredible because we've never really done that. Like,
no, it's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, we all kind of know each other and we see each other about a bit, but that really formed some really strong friendships, which was great. Mm. So that was really supportive. And my staff were amazing. Like, you know, not one of them signed on for any of this. Like I had guys that, you know, had been working the floor at Mamaceta for the last 5 or 6 years or mezcaliers and, you know, that kind of thing, you know, who were doing dishwashing nights here while we're doing drive around takeaways and, you know, like everyone just had to go, all right, I have no title anymore.
Yeah.
We're all just part of a team and we all just pull together and do what we have to do. You know, I myself was driving doing home deliveries sort of 4 nights a week. And that was the same as Luis, my restaurant manager at Mamacita, mainly because out of – so we went from something like 70 staff down to 12 or something.
Wow.
But none of our staff had licenses. No one has a license or no one drives a car. It was amazing. Like, wow. We'd never really thought about it until we needed to.
Yes,
so
right.
There was really only three or four of us that could do the delivery. So we're all doing it every night.
How humbling was that?
Yeah, very. It really was. I remember saying to my wife, the first couple of nights was sort of fun and yes. It was really novel. And I was, you know, and I was doing a lot of delivery. I live in Northcote and there was a lot of people in Northcote supporting us and whatnot. So I was doing rocking up at people's doors and I was meeting people in my community going, and they'd be like, oh, my son goes to school with your son. And, you know,
that's lovely.
So that was lovely, but it got tired pretty quick. In the sense of just driving around, just going, I cannot believe this is what my life has become.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was very humbling. Mm. But yeah, look, I guess just, support networks and my staff having my back.
Mm.
That's what got me through.
Mm.
Yeah. And my wife, like, you know, without her, I couldn't have done any of it. So, yeah.
Do you think it's made you a stronger brand now?
I'm not sure.
Or has it just made it different?
I think it's possibly been good for Hotel Jesus in Collingwood because, as we all know, the suburbs did a lot better than the CBD.
Yeah.
So because all of a sudden we were only doing delivery takeaway, we probably got to deliver to quite a few people in these local areas that we hadn't tried our food before.
Yes.
And we've come back with a bit of a bang. Collingwood's been good. It's been – people are out and as I was saying before we started the podcast, we've reduced the hours a bit.
Yep.
So we've just sort of consolidated everything and it's been really healthy. It's been a nice surprise.
Mm.
The city is – just in the last couple of, I mean, really just the last two weekends, seems like it's come back to life.
Yep.
Fridays and Saturday nights are about 80% of what they were, 70 to 80% of what they were, which is really healthy.
Yeah.
The weeknights are really probably about 40% of what they were.
Right.
So, yeah, the city's a tough one. I think, I'm not sure how everyone's doing in the city, but I know that the few friends I've got who've got restaurants, everyone's probably 60%, 70% maybe over for the week of what they were.
Okay.
So that's going to be
tough.
That's really tough.
Yeah.
You know, because you don't have the people, as I was saying, we used to do five sittings a night at Mamacita. That was in the first probably 5 or 6 years. In the last few years, we'd probably do 3 to 4 sittings a night,
right,
which is still pretty healthy.
You know? Yeah, absolutely.
And now, like, you don't do the 5 o'clock sitting, you don't do the 9 o'clock sitting, you know.
It's
people are coming into the city to support the CBD restaurants.
Sure.
They're not just happening to be walking around after work, having beers, going to the theatre, like that's really dropped off.
Yeah.
So that's, hopefully that doesn't take too long to come back.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, what do you think your indications are? Like, do you think there needs to be a push? Like, I think the city of Melbourne largely is doing a really good job in trying to push people to come back into
amazing
the city
job.
And the state government's doing the same. And, you know, obviously this is not a Melbourne-centric thing.
That's
a worldwide thing
that's right.
Dealing with CBDs across across the world. Like, are you just holding and hoping and knowing it's going to come back and just doing what you guys do so well, which is a great experience, great product, be consistent and then just ride it through? Or are you thinking this is going to be a fundamental change in which you're thinking about your business in a different way, if I can ask you?
I think it's JobKeeper is going to have a massive impact, not just on hospitality, but every single industry, as we all know. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see if, you know, all those businesses in the city that have the massive leaseholds on the massive floors of, office buildings and whatnot can retain that stuff, and if people want to go back into work. Like, there's so many unknowns.
Yes.
That, I think it's, for the moment, it's hold on and wait. And then if it gets dire, then we need to look at strategies as to what to do there.
Hmm.
But yeah, city's scary.
It's very scary.
Yeah.
I'm just glad you're still operational and still positive as we come into this meeting about talking about, you know, where the venues come from and where it is now. So I've appreciated that, Matt.
Cheers. Thanks.
I've got one more question before I let you go, as I do ask on the podcast with every single guest, is what are you looking forward to for this year, both on a personal basis and a professional basis for the venues?
I guess on a professional basis, again, as I said to you, we used to operate 7 days a week at Mamacita and now we're doing 5 days a week. And that's, you know, it's that funny thing as we spoke about, it's like when you've got a business that's paying rent, my old head would have said, you know, while you're open and you're paying rent, you should be
trading
all that time. Whereas now I'm kind of like, I don't know. I think mental health's massive for a lot of people. I've seen a lot of my staff have a really hard time. I've had it, like everyone I know has had a really hard time, and I think that going back into it, plus, you know, I think the old model was a bit broken for hospitality. I think that the labour model's broken, service models have been broken to a degree, and I think now the beauty of having something like this happen, if there can be a beauty in it, is just to take the time out to really look at that and reassess and go, do we need to open 7 days? Maybe not. Mm. Maybe it's just five and everyone works five and gets 2 days off a week, or maybe we work towards a 4 day working week and rotating casuals and all that kind of thing. So we're talking about that a lot at the moment.
Sure.
We're also, you know, Mama said it was such a, like, right up until COVID. So the 6 months prior to COVID, we just had our best 6 months we'd had in 5 or 6 years.
Wow.
At Mama said it just, I don't know what happened. It just sort of bounced back and we were super busy.
Right.
To the point where it was hard to keep up, you know.
Right.
We were like having a struggle making menu changes because we were just so busy that you're just constantly prepping and constantly trying to keep up with the patronage. Whereas now we're doing a lot more food development, and that's really exciting. Mm. You know, we're talking about slowing things down, slowing the service model down.
Yep.
That's exciting. We're all enjoying that.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think is exciting, I guess, professionally this year is diversity. You know, I think we've all thought, how else do we bring revenue in other than just serving people in the restaurant?
Yes.
You know, so we're talking, yeah, man, we talked about cookbooks over the years. That's probably not at the forefront still yet, but we are looking at more educational pieces, like more masterclasses in mezcal and tequila and agave, that kind of thing. Whether we, you know, sort of brand our own cocktails. There's a few different things we're talking about, which is nice to be thinking about something different than just normal day-to-day trade.
100%.
Yeah. Personally, I've realised that I need to have some more hobbies in my life. So I actually rang a mate 2 weeks ago and I said, mate, I'm turning 50 this year. I want to learn to surf. So we've been down to Urban Surf the last 3 weeks, which has just been amazing. You know, I'd tried to sit, you know, I've sort of said that I can surf for the last 20 years. I can't surf. You know, I used to go out and try and get thrown around the waves a bit.
But right, okay.
It's actually been awesome. so that's just something I wouldn't have done pre-COVID, you know. It's, you know, and then I've just got the kids mountain bikes and we're going to look at doing some more mountain biking and, yeah, just, you know, personal care stuff.
Just get out and about, right?
Yeah.
Get in the fresh air.
Yep.
Matt, it's been great to, you know, been an honour to listen to the experience and hear about, you know, such an amazing brand that I really that really personified what Melbourne was to me when I first came here. So I really appreciate your time today.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you.
What's the best way that people can find out about Mamacita?
Sure. So we've got our Instagram handle is Mamacita Melbourne. we're on Facebook as well, and our website is www.mamacita.com.au. They're probably the three major channels.
Perfect.
Yeah.
As always, linked up in the bio of this podcast.
Right.
Matt Lane, thanks so much.
Good on you, Sean. Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning into another episode of Principle of Hospitality, the podcast. We hope you really enjoyed this episode. Please comment, like, and share this podcast with your friends in the industry. We're making this content with the industry in mind, so we'd really appreciate you sharing it along with those that you care about in the industry. Thanks as well to our sponsor, Chef's Hat, the largest family-owned and operated hospitality supplier in Australia. They strive to inspire cooks, chefs, bakers and bartenders to deliver the best product with the best tools every day. We're so proud to partner with them. That's where the industry shops. And if you don't know us at Poe, Sash, my co-founder from Principal Design, has one of the best design agencies in Australia. So if you're looking for anything around strategy, branding, digital design, and graphic design, then you can find them at principaldesign.com.au, and myself at Open Pantry Consulting for anything to do with hospitality operations, strategy, and recruitment. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks to Chef's Hat for supporting us. And until next time, stay safe. Cheers. Thank you.